Hello, and welcome to episode 154 of the Big Rhetorical Podcast. I'm your host, Charles Woods. On this episode of TBR Podcast, I talk with Dr. Lindsay Harding about her new novel, Pilgrims 2.0.
With Annalie's character, like, she is grappling with, like, the loss of her twin sister, and they're both, like, pretty young. So they're, like, in their 30s. They just, like, figure out, they have this, like, plan. They've moved to the same town. They're, like, living together. They're, like, doing this thing that they wanted to do with their adult lives, right? Like, live in the same place together. And I should say, this is something that, like, for my twin sister and I, we haven't been able to figure out. And in fact, she lives in New Zealand now. So, like, on the other side of the world.
You'll hear more from Lindsay in a bit. But first, some news and notes. Right off, make note, the editors of Text Gen Ed are seeking submissions for their next project, Text Gen Ed Continuing Experiments. You can find more information from WAC, since Text Gen Ed is part of the WAC repository. The deadline for the Council for Programs and Technical and Scientific Communication annual meeting is April 29th. Make sure to get your proposals in. This year, the group is meeting in Menominee, Wisconsin on October 8th and 19th. And Florida Atlantic's Department of English in Boca Raton, Florida is looking to hire 3 new instructor lines, and they welcome applicants interested in an assistant director position at the University Center for Excellence in Writing. Boca Raton. Sounds nice, I guess. Also, Marquette is hiring. I noticed that. A lot of Wisconsin here in the introduction. No, I still haven't made it to Writing Buddies. Lindsay Harding directs the Writing Intensive Program at the University of Georgia, where she earned her PhD in English in 2015. Her debut novel, Pilgrims 2.0, was published by Acre Books in 2023. Her recent flash fiction and stories have appeared in Palisades Review, Lost Balloon, Trap, Apps, Spry Literary Journal, and Prick of the Spindle. She lives in Athens, Georgia, with her husband and 4 children. And you can find more information about Lindsay online at lmharding.com. I hope you enjoyed my interview with Lindsay Harding about her new book, her debut novel, Pilgrims 2.0. Who are you? What's your name, your title, and your institution and your role there? Who are you and what do you do?
My name is Lindsay Harding, and I am the director of the Franklin College Writing Intensive Program at the University of Georgia.
Oh, awesome. So you live in Athens?
I do, yes.
How long have you worked or been in Athens or worked at the University of Georgia? I guess what I'm asking is, how long have you been in your role, really?
I have been in my role 9 years so far. I did transition a couple years in from assistant director of this WACWID initiative to the director, but I've been working with the same program in the same role since I started on faculty here. And then before that, I did my PhD at the University of Georgia, too, in the Department of English. And so I was in Athens. So I've been in Athens for 4 additional years and really love it here. It's the only place I've lived that I've really felt like I'm at home. I feel at home here. So that's been really nice.
Okay. So are you from Athens?
No.
Where are you from?
I grew up Western Pennsylvania, Western New York. So, like, suburbs of Pittsburgh for most of my childhood, and then moved to Western New York, Jamestown, up there for a couple years, then moved across the state for undergrad at Columbia in New York City, and then a little bit more time up north, and then I was desperate to be warm, so moved down south.
Okay, so that sounds like you've been all over. So why Athens? How did you wind up in Athens?
When I first moved down south, my husband and I were teaching at an independent school in Gainesville, Florida, And so we liked, you know, the college town vibe and atmosphere. But I had finished my MFA in creative writing at the Swanee School of Letters, and I wasn't ready to be done with school yet. So in looking at programs with a PhD that had a creative component, the University of Georgia was pretty high on my list because I was really excited to have the chance to maybe work with the writer Judith Ortiz Cofer, who was my major professor until she retired kind of like while I was in my program. But yeah, that's kind of what brought us to town.
That's super cool. So let me ask a couple of questions about the Georgia writing program. So you are a creative writer, and we're going to get into talking about your novel Pilgrims 2.0 in a minute. All right. But you're also a writing program administrator, right? You work with graduate assistants, you teach writing program courses and other courses. How are you navigating that, right? Being a creative writer and a writing program administrator? I think this is a critical question.
Yeah, and actually, it seems like there's a lot of that overlap in the field. I feel like I talk to a lot of writing program administrators who have a creative background.
Yeah,
I think what's really great about it is like being as an administrator, I feel like I do have to think on my toes and creatively an awful lot. So whether that's coming up with like different ideas for programming and how to like pitch writing to different stakeholders across campus and how to sell writing or writing pedagogy to graduate teaching assistants or faculty who know that they want to teach writing, but you know, maybe haven't quite been drinking the Kool-Aid yet. So I feel like all of those sorts of areas, I'm like able to leverage like a lot of the creative thinking and those types of skills that I pulled from, you know, just like thinking as a creative writer, as a fiction writer. I also think, you know, just as a writer, like I'm always sort of thinking about like what I'm seeing and how I observe like the world and trying to pull all of that stuff back into my work. And I think that actually has been really helpful for me as a writing program administrator too, because I try to like look for like other possibilities and different collaborators. And that part's really fun. To kind of to have like, you know, different and like divergent ways of interacting with people and thinking about like writing and its place in a university.
Can I just pause and say, if you're listening to this podcast, go ahead and download it and cut that last answer out, question and answer out. That was awesome, Lindsay. And I agree with you 100%. That's why I wanted to hear someone talk about that, right? So much of the administrative duties and role, right, if you will, just blanket that, requires this creativity, right? That so many of us, oftentimes don't get to do in our jobs, right? And so we have to reframe it and rethink about it. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah.
Pilgrims 2.0. Okay. So the question I usually ask is something along the lines of, how did this book come to be? And I'm going to ask you that. Okay. How did this book come to be? But when did you start writing this book? When did this idea come into your mind? Is this something that's been long gestating for 2 decades? Or was this like, oh my gosh, I saw this on the internet. Let me write this incredible novel about it. How did this book come to be?
So the timeline is definitely a longer one. And I usually tell people a decade just because that sounds nice, but actually it's a little bit longer than a decade. I had the initial idea when I first started my PhD in English here at UGA, and that would have been the fall of 2011, so forever ago. And that first semester...
Three economic crises ago. Like, yeah, that was like a while ago.
So that first semester, I couldn't take a creative workshop yet. So I was actually taking a composition pedagogy practicum, and the class that got closest to a literature class that I took, which was a book history course with Dr. Sujata Iyengar. And for that class, the creative writers in the group, we were able to design our own final project to leverage sort of our interest in what we were reading and studying that semester with our own kind of creative interests. And so after reading Chaucer's Canterbury Tales or excerpts from it and talking about it, I was like, I had this idea about a plastic surgery cruise. And then I was like, oh, perfect. It'll be a plastic pilgrimage set on a plastic surgery cruise. And Dr. Iyengar was all in. The project was greenlit. And so it started really as like Chaucer fan fiction and an attempt to sort of rewrite his tales in a like modern beach read sort of way. But still at that time, it still had like the Chaucerian style to it. So a ton of like alliteration and just like kind of more playful language and things that sounded like old fashioned, I guess. And then the next semester, I had a workshop with Judith Ortiz Kofer, and her big thing was produce pages. So she wanted us to produce like 20 pages every 2 weeks for workshops, something in that kind of ballpark. And that was great because then I got to like flesh out this project, kind of see where it could go. And then after that, it just sort of like kind of evolved wildly over the years. At some point, close to when I was finishing my program, I was approaching a full draft, but I wasn't quite there yet. And I got some feedback from a friend of mine, Robbie Nadler, and he had generously read the draft, offered to give me some feedback. And he was the one who actually thought that maybe the boat could be its own character and kind of come to life with AI. And that sort of like clicked something for me. And I was like, yes, it was like the piece that the book was missing, like the boat as a character. And this was probably 2015. So like way well before ChatGPT. And so that kind of set me off on a major revision. And then I finished the book, maybe like a year and a half, like a full draft kind of ready to go out on submission to agents, a year and a half after our youngest child was born, who's now 7. So I had done like a 2-week writing retreat, and I used all of that time to like wildly revise and kind of push things through. And then I closed out the year, that year, I guess it was 2017, with a full draft to go out on submission. And it wasn't done yet because my agent wasn't able to sell it. It still needed some work. So I went out, I pitched it to a couple small presses, and the book's publisher, Acre Books, and their fiction editor, Nicola Mason, offered some feedback. And again, it was like this other like light bulb moment. And I did a very intensive revision for one fall semester, writing every day for at least 10 minutes a day, 7 days a week. Knocked it out it was like by the end of the year, I like had this email to go back to her. And then we tweaked for a little bit long for another year or so. And then she announced that it was ready to come out, and she announced it for the fall 2023 list. So from Chaucer to Acre Books.
That's incredible. I have a lot of comments and questions, and we're going to unpack this. And the first thing that comes to mind is I love the like intertextuality thing here, right? That's going on. That's obviously going to be a hallmark of like great literature for most of us. Well, that's the way we're taught anyway. So that's outstanding and so brilliant. So here's my like super simple question, but it's probably a complex answer. Is this then an adaptation of the Canterbury Tales? Is that how you see it?
Initially, yes. I think I've kind of gotten away from there, but still with like some like touchstones. I mean, I'm definitely thinking about it in naming like the cruise line Canterbury Cruise Line and the boat's Pilgrim. So I wanted to like nod to like to the history of the book and like and where it came from and where it started. But I do think, you know, even in terms of like the characters' journeys, there still maybe is that sense that they are on this pilgrimage. Slightly, you know, different, obviously, in terms of like what they're aiming for. But even like in terms of how I was like navigating their backstory and bringing that into what they wanted and how they interacted with each other and other people on the boat. I can see some of that still sort of like energy lingering.
So the thing that is so great is the title, Pilgrims 2.0. What's the 2.0? How does that work? What does that mean?
Yeah. And I should say initially, I guess in terms of like progression of the title. So the initial school project was called the Plastic Pilgrimage. From there, it graduated to Bon Voyage. So play on Bon Voyage, which I loved, but I knew it probably wasn't going to be the thing to that would be on the book cover. So with Pilgrims 2.0, I think they're the sense of like the 2.0, like really kind of capturing the sense of like technology too, and like how we have like Web 2.0. And like, so it's this like evolution of technology and also like of this like voyage. So sort of like a pilgrimage that's like this new version of it, but with a nod to like the role that technology is going to play in that. And I think even for the characters, for themselves, kind of coming out of plastic surgery as like the 2.0 version of themselves is something that I think the title also speaks to.
So we're going to talk a little bit about your family and stuff like that. I want to get to that, but I want to focus on the characters and some of the narrative structure since we're here. Do you have a favorite character in the book? And who is it, if so?
Okay.
And why?
I have two favorite characters. One, Annalie. And I think she's my favorite because she's like a twin and I'm a twin. And while her storyline is like a very, very sad one, it's one that's like very near and dear to my heart, just because like my sister and I are very close. And so I think in writing that character and what she's going through in the book and grappling with was like a way of sort of just capturing like, you know, this relationship that I have with my twin and how important it is to me. But I will also say that Larry's character, and he's like the wild card crew member on the ship, was by far my favorite character to write, which definitely, you know, he's a little on the dark side, a little on the twisted side. And man, is it fun to like think of things in trouble that he can get into. And so I like that part too.
What kind of trouble does Larry get into without giving too much away in the book?
Okay, without giving too much away. Okay, a good example is at one point, he does things like this all the time. So like he will just like mess with the passengers. So instead of like bringing the drinks that like he's supposed to bring to like the right passenger, he like will mix them. So he'll give like a passenger who requested like a smoothie, a hot chai instead, or something like that. There's a passenger sleeping and she has a book like tented open near her, and he like switches where the tent is so then she can't find her spot when she wakes up. And he likes to think about how she's going to keep trying to find like where she left off on those two pages that are open and not be able to find it.
I kind of like Larry.
Gets into much more serious trouble, but those are like the little things that he just likes to mess with. Oh, and he likes to steal, like take things also.
Okay. I like Larry now. I like Larry less now, I guess. But you mentioned the twin relationship, right? That you were a twin, and that this is really at the heart of the book for you. And so I want to give you some more space to kind of talk about why and how that works.
Yeah, I think with Annalie's character, like she is grappling with like the loss of her twin sister and they're both like pretty young. So they're like in their 30s. They just like figure out, they have this like plan. They've moved to the same town. They're like living together. They're like doing this thing that they wanted to do with their adult lives, right? Like live in the same place together. And I should say, this is something that like for my twin sister and I, we haven't been able to figure out. And in fact, she lives in New Zealand now. So like on the other side of the world, but we're still really close. We talk all the time and see each other a couple, like once or twice a year. But for these twins, like they had figured it out. Like this was like on the horizon for them, these like adult living, these adult lives together as like the best friends that they were. And then her sister dies. And so then I think That's a question that like my sister and I talk about, right? Like what, like at some point one of us is going to die first. Like, what does that mean for the other person? Like how will we endure it? And I think that's like, that's the question that's like really at the heart of this book is like, how does a twin live? And when they don't have their twin anymore. And so then like, if you, I was like, well, maybe she just can't stand to like see herself in the mirror because they look so much alike. It feels like that would be like incredibly painful, just to kind of see like those traces like all the time in the mirror. And so she's thinking like plastic surgery as like a way to kind of circumnavigate that, and maybe like try to figure out like this new life and this new world that she has to exist in alone.
What did your twin think about the book?
She loved it. I mean, she's probably read it like so many times at this point because I did share like early drafts. Also, she was one of my like medical consultants for the book. There's a lot of like medicine in it. There's a lot of anesthesia because if I was like, I wanted to like have things seem like they could be procedures and things that were like possible, but also I was like, I needed to push the limits. Like I wanted women to like go into this operating room on a cruise ship and like come out as like a completely different person. And like, how, what's the anesthesia situation to make that possible? And she and my mom, who are both, they're both anesthesiologists, answered endless questions from me about like drugs and titrations and what kinds of side effects. And so she was like kind of very close to this book all along for the last, yeah, like 13, 14 years.
That's awesome. Okay. So that sounds like some great research to do, right? Have in the medical, for the medical stuff aspects of the book. Did you get to go on cruises too, right? To study that? So listeners, I have never been on a cruise. I don't, it's just something that has never happened for me. So anyway.
Well, so growing up, we went on a couple cruises, including at least one, but maybe two Disney cruises. And then as an adult, I've been on three cruises. Although I should say the last one was like before I had kids. So at least like 15 years ago at this point. But maybe like once you cruise, like you just know cruises. And it is like a fascinating world. I also like that it's like limited in a very kind of productive way. Like space-wise, like every, I was like, oh, this is cool. I can like, I've got this container that I can just like fill with stuff as a writer. And I really liked that part. And then also, yeah, thinking about, you know, kind of going somewhere and then coming back. Even that part of like a cruise, I thought would be like an interesting thing to play with.
No, it's really brilliant, right? Pilgrimage, a cruise. That's smart. So we talked about your twin. Let's talk and kind of her response to the book, but I also want to talk about your family because you mentioned you have kids. And so raising a family and writing a book, on top of being a writing program administrator and teaching courses and all of that stuff, you know, how did raising a family impact and influence, I guess, this project? And I'm going to just kind of pause and let you kind of take it from there.
Okay. So as I think in terms of like impact, maybe the hit that it takes is like a time one, right? So I definitely think, you know, this book just took a while because I was like having kids and raising small kids while it was like in process and in progress. I was able to get a parents grant from the Sustainable Arts Foundation for a 2-week writer's retreat at the Rivendell Writers Colony. It's no longer around, sadly, and I was actually in one of the last groups that was able to go and stay there. And that time was an incredibly valuable time. Just for me as a writer, I was very thankful to have that opportunity and like the resources to be able to go. And then in general too, I think like with like having a having the family, I spend a lot of time in cars and driving people to places, and then they'll have like practice somewhere for sometimes like an hour and a half or 2 hours. And so I wrote a lot of this book in the car, like with my laptop on my lap. But that was great. I was like, what else are you going to do for an hour and a half? And you have to come back and get the kids anyways. So even some mornings I would take my now 15-year-old to 5:30 a.m. swim practice, and just like pull out my computer until I couldn't keep my eyes open, and then maybe nod off a little bit at the end. But on those mornings when she had morning swim, I was able to get some morning writing in like a quiet place, that was, you know, pretty distraction free. So I think like trying to like squeeze in like different writing sessions, has helped me be like a more flexible writer. I can kind of write anywhere, and sort of at any time.
What a gift.
Just from like, you know, sheer like need to do it, but also like practice too. I will say too, when I was doing the last big revision, I was committed to like writing every day. And recently I've started that up again, but I've added like a bounty to it. So if I don't write for at least 10 minutes a day, like something creative, a short story or working on my second book, I owe my 15-year-old $5. So I've been doing this every day since November 1. I think she's gotten like $10 or $15 off of me, but I've gotten like a ton of words out of this. That's nice. Like it's nice to have this like practice that has been like really sustainable for me.
That's awesome. Now I can't wait for my daughter to be old enough to understand the value of money. So I'm going to be so productive when I institute my own bounty here in Texas.
One other thing I was thinking about recently is, I do feel like I haven't like pushed this at all, but like my kids, for the past couple years, 1 to 3 of them have done the National Novel Writing Month Challenge in November. And I am like incredibly inspired by them doing that. I can't do that. I can't write 50,000 words in a month, but they're like doing sports and school and somehow they're able to get it done. And so I feel like, maybe, you know, they get to see me as a writer, but like, I also get to see them as writers and budding aspiring writers. And I'm definitely kind of, you know, trying to like capitalize on their energy and momentum too.
That's beautiful. That is one of the most beautiful moments of the entire podcast, Lindsay. Thanks for sharing that. And I'm talking about all 150 plus episodes. That was awesome. So it's interesting how your relationship with being a parent, relationship with your kids, that sounds ridiculous. Being a parent impacted where you write, right? And the time, like you can write anywhere, and also at any time. How did that impact, or did it impact, or the narrative structure of the book? Kind of what is the narrative structure? How does that work?
Yeah. I definitely think there's a relationship there. Speaking of relationships, a relationship there between narrative structure and like my writing life and the conditions of it, with having kind of a big bustling family. The novel is kind of, it's, you know, approaching 400 pages. I think it's like 396. It looks like a pretty big book too. People kind of pick it up and they're like, whoa. But it's short chapters. Most chapters are like, maybe like 2 to 4 pages somewhere in there. Some are like not even a full page in length. So it kind of like, it has like some zip to it in that way. You're kind of going through like different characters' points of view and different things happening on the boat. And then it's set up also as a cruise would be set up. So you're kind of going through like 2 weeks, like a 2 week cruise, duration of the cruise. Once the characters are on the boat, the cruise days kind of start with like one of those, if you haven't cruised, they used to slide these like itineraries under your door. I remember this from when I was a kid. And it would just like have like all the activities on board the boat that day. And so I, that was something that I added to the book pretty late in the game. But I kind of loved it. So each day has like its own itinerary sheet that starts it. And yeah, so it's kind of like, it's very segmented. It's like very broken up into short chapters. And I do think that is attached to like how I was writing it. Cause I was like dipping in and out of the book so much, that having the short chapters kind of getting to like the end of something that wasn't super long was like really helpful for me as a writer. And then in thinking about it as a whole, though, I do think it kind of helps like move the book along. Also, I like the energy of short chapters because you can, I even get sort of tired sometimes in like a long chapter. And this way you're sort of, you just get to like see all these different things that are happening on a boat. And that also feels like appropriate for a cruise where like maybe you're like walking around deck and you're looking over here at, you know, people sunbathing. And then like over here, there's like some wacky contest happening. And so I think I was also trying to channel that energy at the same time that it was like helpful for me as a writer to be like, oh, I've got an hour. Great. I can revise this like chapter and then move on.
Okay. You know what it makes me think of? And you're going to, it's like this book about a boat and it has short chapters like Moby Dick. Right, that's brilliant, right?
Exactly.
I guess I hope that was okay. I hope that was okay. I like to say that. I thought that it was glaring and like looking at me in the face, like she did this on purpose, right? Where can folks find information about the book online? Where can they get it?
Great question. It is available on the press's website, so Acre Books website. The distributor is the University of Chicago, so it's available on their website. It's also, you can find it on bookshop.org, which is great because then that supports like local independent bookstores. And of course, it's also available on Amazon too.
So when are we going to option this to be a film? Because it's such a good idea. What do you think? Is that a goal? Oh, is that an idea?
I mean, I would love that. And also, I think kind of all along, actually, even from like when I was working with Judith Ortiz Cofer on this, she was like, there's something like very cinematic about it. And it kind of always sort of like felt that way to me, too. I do think it would be a super fun like show. Also, you could do it as a show, right? Like the book is like one cruise number 52, but you could probably take it kind of like White Lotus and do like different seasons of it and different like on different cruises. So that could be really fun. Also, yeah, the characters, I think, you know, you've got like a core set of like four women. You know, I grew up watching like Sex in the City and shows like that, where you have these like four women coming together for a show. So yes, I mean, and like plastic surgery shows, I think are also kind of, I've watched a couple on Netflix lately. I think it's something that also has like changed a lot in terms of like how we view plastic surgery and the types
of.
What
do you mean? Oh, you were about to say that. Sorry.
No, you're good. Yeah. I think just in terms, it seems like this is very anecdotal. But from my kind of like media viewing and consumption experience, and just even then, like anecdotally among friends, like more people are just like opting for plastic surgery, even at like younger ages. And maybe plastic surgery, I kind of mean like stretching that to also include just like skin procedures and things like that. And just seeing like on, I don't know, shows like Netflix's like Love is Blind, like you have all these like young, beautiful women, but they have like fillers, they have Botox. And it's happening in a way that's like, I think people are just like talking about it more. They're more open about it. And then I liked imagining, well, like, but what if you, how could you push it into like these other extremes that maybe we haven't considered yet? And so a couple of the characters in the book, like that's where like they want a solution to like a big problem they're having in their life. And they're like, well, maybe this could be the thing that gets me to like where I want to be and like the person I want to be. And I, I think that would be like fun to like, you know, see and to like see like how this boat is like, you know, appears on the like on a screen. That could be really cool too.
This has been such a great interview. I hope that you've enjoyed it because I've enjoyed talking to you so much. And folks should rush out and read Pilgrims 2.0. What are you doing this afternoon, Lindsay?
Oh, good question. One more meeting. And then obviously, I am going to go pick up some children from school and take them to swim practice and then soccer practice.
You said you have like four, right? Four, three or four kids. My brother has three. I only have one. But this last weekend, we were texting. He had to go to one town for a baseball game. His wife, my sister-in-law, had to go to another town with the other kid for the baseball game. And then my dad had to, their grandfather had to step in and take the other kid to another baseball game in a different city. Like, how do academics get anything done?
Yeah, I mean, not on the weekend. Not on the weekend. That sounds so familiar. But what's funny is I actually don't mention like the B word baseball or the S word softball because I'm like, those sports take so much time, so much time. And swimming is like is a very time intensive thing. But I can like sit at a meet and work, and I'm only watching swimming for like 10 minutes. But yeah, it's funny. I do maybe steer the kids to short term games and sports.
It makes sense to me. Lindsay, this has been great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was like such a pleasure to get to talk to you again. I'm so honored that you reached out to me to set this up. So thank you.
Lindsay's awesome, isn't she? And Pilgrims 2.0 sounds like a really great novel. I really enjoyed that conversation. You know, I actually talked to Lindsay as a part of a WAC Clearinghouse roundtable on the podcast a few years ago. And I've kind of always kept up with the stuff she was doing. And I'm glad I got to talk to her about her novel. Make sure to pick up your copy of Pilgrims 2.0 by Lindsay Harding from Acre Books. Maybe I'll write a novel one day. Okay, folks, the semester is winding down and I have a ton of stuff to do still, and I know you do too. I'll be back next week with another new episode of TBR Podcast. Until then, always be listening rhetorically.
The Big Rhetorical Podcast is produced by Exalt Digital Media. Exalt Digital Media, not for profit. The Big Rhetorical Podcast was recorded on the land of many Native nations, past and present. These original homelands are territories of indigenous peoples who are largely dispossessed and removed. We specifically acknowledge the traditional stewardship of this land by the Wichita, Kickapoo, and Tawakoni peoples. Music for the Big Rhetorical Podcast is brought to you by DJ Lane, Steph Helix, M. Mechonite,